What up, what up, what up, world? It's the Kid Polo Paul coming back to you once again with another episode of the Mad Stash Minute. Today we shall highlight the beautiful Zora Neale Hurston. Miss Hurston was a scholar whose ethnographic research made her a pioneer writer for folk fiction about the Black South. It made her a prominent writer in the Harlem Renaissance. She's most notably famous for her piece of literature titled Their Eyes Were Watching God, which was published in 1937. However, on the Mustache Minute, we're going to be taking a couple of minutes to delve a little bit deep into the life and the history of the beautiful soul of Zora Neale Hurston. So stay tuned. Bow.
This is the Mustache Minute.
Alright, and we're back. So to continue on, we are talking about Zora Neale Hurston and her beautiful legacy in Black history. Zora Neale Hurston was born January 7th in 1891 in Alabama. She then moved to with her family to Eatonville, Florida, where she was still a toddler. Her writings reveal no recollection of her Alabama beginnings. For Hurston, Eatonville was always home. Established in 1887, the rural community near Orlando was the nation's first incorporated Black township. It was, as Hurston described it, a city of five lakes, three croquet courts, 300 brown skins, 300 good swimmers, plenty of guava, two schools, and no jailhouse. In Eatonville, Zora was never indoctrinated in inferiority, and she could see the evidence of Black achievement all around her. She could look into the town hall and see Black men, including her father, John Hurston, formulating the laws that govern Eatonville. She could look to the Sunday schools of the town's two churches and see Black women, including her mother, Lucy Potts Hurston, directing the Christian curricula. She could look to the porch of the village store and see Black men and women passing worlds through their mouths in the form of colorful, engaging stories. Growing up in this culturally affirming setting in an 8-room house on 5 acres of land, Zora had a relatively happy childhood. Despite frequent clashes with her preacher father, who sometimes sought to, quote, squench her rebellious spirit, she recalled, her mother, on the other hand, urged young Zora and her 7 siblings to jump at the sun. Hurston explained, "We might not land on the sun, but at least we can get off the ground." Hurston's childhood came to an abrupt end, though, when her mother died in 1904. Zora was only 13 years old. Quote, "That hour began my wanderings," she later wrote. "Not so much in geography, but in time. Then so much in time is in spirit." After Lucy Hurston's death, Zora's father quickly remarried to a young woman who the hot-headed Zora almost killed in a fistfight and seemed to have little time or money for his children. Barren bony of comfort and love, Zora worked a series of menial jobs over the ensuing years, struggled to finish her schooling, and eventually joined a Gilbert and Sullivan traveling troupe as a maid to the lead singer. In 1917, she turned up in Baltimore, my hometown. By then, she was 26 years old and still hadn't finished high school. Needing to present herself as a teenager to qualify for free public schooling, she lopped 10 years off her life, giving her age as 16 and the year of her birth as 1901. Once gone, those years were never restored. From that moment forward, Hurston will always present herself as at least 10 years younger than she actually was. Apparently, she had the looks to pull it off. Ow. Photographs revealed that she was a beautiful woman with playful yet penetrating eyes, high cheekbones, and a full grace mouth that was never without expression. Zora also had a fiery intellect, an infectious sense of humor, and, quote, the gift, as one would put it, of walking into hearts. Zora used these talents and dozens more to elbow her way into the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s, befriending such luminaries as poets such as Langston Hughes and a popular singer and actress, Ethel Waters. Through Hurston's rarely drink, fellow writer Sterling Brown recalled, when Zora was there, she was always the party. Another friend remembered Hurston's apartment furnished by donations she solicited from friends as a spirited open house for artists. All this socializing didn't keep Hurston from her work, though. She would sometimes write in her bedroom while the party went on in the living room. By 1935, Hurston, who graduated from Barnard College in 1928, had published several short stories and articles, as well as a novel, Jonas Gourdvine, and well-received collection of Black Southern folklore, Muse and Men. But the late 1930s and early 40s marked the real zenith of her career. She then published her masterwork, Their Eyes Were Watching God, in 1937. Tell My Horse, her study of Caribbean voodoo practices, in 1938, and another masterful novel, Moses, Man of the Mountain, in 1939. When her autobiography, Dust Tracks on a Roll, was published in 1942, Hurston's finally received the well-earned acclaim that had long eluded her. That year, she was profiled in Who's Who in America, Current Biography, and 20th Century Authors. She went on to publish another novel, Seraph on the Swanee, in 1948. Still, Hurston never received the financial rewards she yet deserved. The largest royalty she ever earned from any of her books was $943.75. So when she died January 28, 1960, at age 69, after suffering a stroke, her neighbors in Fort Pierce, Florida, had to take up a collection for her February 7th funeral. The collection didn't yield enough to pay for a headstone, however, so Hurston was buried in a grave that remained unmarked until 1973. That summer, a young writer named Alice Walker traveled to Fort Pierce to place a marker on the grave of the author who had inspired so much work of her own. Walker found the Guardian of the Heavenly Breast, a segregated cemetery that the dead end of the North 17th Street, abandoned and overgrown with yellow-flowered weeds. Back in 1945, Hurston had foreseen the possibility of dying without money, and she proposed a solution that would have benefited her artists and countless others. Writing to W.E.B. Du Bois, whom she called the, quote, Dean of American Negro Artists, quote, Hurston suggested a cemetery for the illustrious Negro dead on 100 acres of land in Florida. Citing practical complications, Du Bois wrote a curt reply discounting Hurst's persuasive argument. Let no Negro celebrity, no matter what financial condition they might be in at death, lie in inconspicuous forgetfulness, she urged. We must assume the responsibility of their graves being known and honored. As in, if implied by those words, Walker bravely entered the snake-infested cemetery where Hurston's remains had been laid to rest. Wading through the high-waist weeds, she soon stumbled upon a sunken rectangular patch of ground that she determined to be Hurston's grave. Unable to afford the marker, she went and purchased a tall, majestic black stone called Ebony Mist. Walker chose a plain gray headstone instead, despite having the Ebony Mist, you know, in her grasp. But borrowing from a Jean Toomer poem, she dressed the marker up with a fitting epitaph stating, Zora Neale Hurston, a genius of the South, with yet another one of her ancestors. Miss Hurston displayed grace, perseverance, expression, and art in the purest form, and pushed for her people to not be lost nor forgotten, regardless of how high nor how low their status is. I hope that her love for the arts, legacy, and love for her people may inspire anyone out there to always express your passion. So here's to another episode of the Mad Stash Minute. And of course, until next time, Stashers, this is Polo Paul signing up. Bow.
I love you, Daddy.